worked with some of the most vulnerable areas and communities. 1.5 tends to be the red line, thinking of some of the Pacific communities. 1.5 is the difference between, you know, staying literally afloat and sinking. India had this series of heat waves. So the 2020 heat wave that started as early as early March, which is unthinkable. The heat tolerant seeds are just not equipped to withstand those kind of heats. We were talking of 47, 48 degrees heat.
We wish to acknowledge the Indigenous people of Australia, the wider Asia Pacific region and other parts of the world, and express our respect for their traditional knowledge and practices, which stem from a deep connection to the lands and waters they have inhabited for millennia.
Welcome to Dev Policy Talks, the podcast of the Development Policy Centre. We're part of the Crawford School of Public Policy at the Australian National University on Ngunnawal and Ngambri country in Canberra. I'm Robin Davies. This is our 12th season. We're bringing you a mix of interviews, event recordings and in-depth features on topics central to our research: Australia's overseas aid, development in Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and other regional and global development issues. In this episode, I speak with Dr. Aditi Mukherjee, Principal Scientist at the International Livestock Research Institute. She's a leading voice in climate change adaptation research. Dr. Mukherjee's career has taken her from challenging conventional wisdom about groundwater scarcity in eastern India to rehabilitating dying springs in the Himalayas. Her early work led to policy changes benefiting 200,000 farmers. In the Himalayas, she examined how infrastructure development was disrupting ancient water systems. As a Gates Cambridge scholar, she conducted groundbreaking research. This work demonstrated how policy barriers, rather than water scarcity itself, prevented sustainable agricultural development in high rainfall regions of India. More recently, Dr. Mukherjee served as coordinating lead author of the water chapter in the IPCC's sixth assessment report. In that role, she synthesized global evidence showing that climate change has transformed every component of the water cycle. The impacts fall disproportionately on vulnerable populations in the global south. Her work reveals uncomfortable truths about the declining effectiveness of adaptation measures as temperatures rise. It also highlights the critical importance of the 1.5 degree threshold. For Pacific Island nations in particular, this threshold could represent the difference between survival and inundation. In our conversation, we explore several key themes. These include her journey from the climate-vulnerable Sundarbans region to the forefront of international climate science. We discuss the complex interplay between infrastructure development and water security in the Himalayas. We examine what the IPCC's assessment reveals about climate impacts on agriculture. And we consider why pastoral communities in Africa require different approaches to livestock and climate policy. We also discuss Australia's potential role in supporting climate adaptation globally. Before we begin, I should note a significant development since this interview was recorded. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has announced that the 1.5 degree global temperature increase threshold has been surpassed. We're also now on the eve of COP30 in Brazil. There, the international community will grapple with the implications of crossing this critical threshold. These developments give added weight to Dr. Mukherjee's discussion here.
My name is Dr. Aditi Mukherjee. I work with the CGIAR as a principal scientist with the International Livestock Research Center. And my area of specialization is climate change and climate change adaptation.
I always like to ask at the beginning how you sort of entered into your current line of work. I understand that you had some personal experience with water scarcity, salinity in India, where you grew up. So could you tell me a bit about that experience and ultimately how that led you into your profession?
So I started working with the CGIAR way back in 2001, right after my master's. So I grew up in a city in India, in several cities, in Calcutta, in Delhi. But my family house was in one of the most, one of the most climate vulnerable areas called the Sundarbans. Those are the mangrove forest at the edge of, in the Bay of Bengal that covers both West Bengal and Bangladesh. So early on, part of my childhood was spent in my ancestral village. And growing up, I have seen, so my extended family was involved in agriculture, while I myself, I was brought up in a city, and I had the pretty much the standard city-based education, not directly involved with agriculture on a day-to-day basis. It just so happened that after I finished my college and my master's, I was offered a job with the International Water Management Institute. They used to have a program called the EME Tata program, funded by the Tata, which is a big industrial house in India, but also now worldwide. And that's when I started working on irrigation, and a lot of the early growing up experience that I had, albeit second hand, of my family, of my extended family, been involved in agriculture, in farming, and of the things that I had heard around climate vulnerability, around salinization, around how hard it was to do farming in some of those really, really climate vulnerable areas. I think that background was very useful to have as I started on my own career as a researcher within the CGIAR.
And I believe you, after obtaining your initial qualifications in India, you obtained a Gates Scholarship to Cambridge. How did that come about?
Yes. So after working around two and a half years with the EME Tata program, I was offered this, offered an admission to Cambridge, where I got the Gates Cambridge Scholarship. So that actually allowed me to continue the work I was doing at EME, which was looking at how do farmers use water optimally for irrigation. And more particularly, I was very interested in issues of groundwater. As you know, India is the world's largest user of groundwater. Actually, a quarter of the world's groundwater gets used in India, and we have the largest number of groundwater pumps. So this was a big issue, and the part of India I was studying, my own home state, that was a part that received relatively high rainfall but had a number of restrictions on farmers on how they accessed irrigation. So that ultimately became the topic of my research, and that led to some quite nice policy changes that ended up influencing, that ended up benefiting more than 200,000 farmers. So that was the work that I had started and was able to continue at Cambridge with the generous support from the Gates Foundation, Gates Cambridge Scholarship.
And I think what you found in your research is that the fundamental issue wasn't water scarcity. It was a range of policy settings, including in the energy sector. Could you talk a bit about what you found?
That remains one of my favorite pieces of work. So generally, when I started this work in early 2000, a lot of the discourse in India had been shaped by severe water scarcity in northern and western part of India, where water scarcity is a real issue because those regions get a lot less rainfall. They have a much more intensive agricultural system, much less recharge. So the thing with discourses is when once it takes hold, it captures the popular imagination of people. So when I started working in eastern India, where the rainfall was three or four times more than, say, in Punjab, the mindset of people still was that groundwater, there is already a scarcity of groundwater, which wasn't true, because of higher rainfall and also the kind of aquifer that that part of India had, which was alluvial aquifer, and it recharged quite well because of the high rainfall. So I think the assumption still was that groundwater is something that cannot be used sustainably. In that circumstance, what I found was there were policy restrictions. For example, if farmers needed to connect to the electricity grid, they had to actually take permission from the groundwater department, which in theory sounds okay, but in practice was really a complex phenomena because the groundwater department often was in the capital city of the state, and farmers from all over the villages, all over the state had to come and get a permit. It was very bureaucratic, and it also in some cases led to rent seeking and corruption. So through the work that I did at EME Tata and with partners, we were able to show that if farmers were charged a market price, a metered rate for their electricity connection, and if they had the proper incentive, there was, and because the rainfall and the recharge were sufficient, we were able to show that connecting them to the electricity grid would not necessarily lead to groundwater overexploitation. In fact, it would lead to better utilization of groundwater. And so this work that went on for 6-7 years, then something quite serendipitous thing happened, in the sense there was a change in government. The state government of West Bengal, which was there for almost 30-35 years, they were a new government came in, and the new government wanted a change. So at that point, the research that I have been doing for all these years came quite useful. And then we had conversations with the chief minister of the state and with her senior policymakers, and I presented the findings of the study, and that led to a change in the groundwater law, which then resulted in almost 200,000 farmers getting a new electricity connection. And while it mattered because earlier they were using diesel, which was not only much more polluting, but also much more expensive. So with the electricity connection, and gradually as our electricity grids become cleaner and cleaner, so we have an opportunity of pumping groundwater in a sustainable way while we are charging farmers on a metered basis. So they have some economic incentive not to overpump, while it's also we are gleaning them out of a much more dirtier fossil fuel, which is diesel. So that was a very satisfying piece of work very early on in my career. It took time, but it did happen. And not because not many people were working on that field. So it was also quite clearly attributable to the work we had done, which was also quite nice. So because in some ways I was going against the flow of the conventional wisdom that groundwater irrigation is always bad. So that, I think, that paid off.
So we've talked about your research on a situation where water scarcity wasn't actually the problem, but of course in much of India and much of the world, it is increasingly a problem. Could you talk a bit about the work you've done on, for example, the problem of drying springs in the uplands of India and elsewhere, and what impact that is having on agriculture?
Right. You're right. I mean, the situation we found in West Bengal and Bangladesh is quite unique because of its very particular geography. It receives a really high rainfall of 1,500 millimeter to 2,000 millimeter of rainfall. Maybe something that you would also find up in parts of Southeast Asia. Then you also have a very good, like a delta, very big rivers that drains those places. So the situation about not having water scarcity is not the norm, as you rightly say. The other work that I did in this context of water scarcity was in the Himalayas. So Himalayas are, again, intuitively, if you look at it, those are the places which shouldn't have water scarcity, because those are literally the water towers of Asia. All 10 major rivers come from the Himalayas. So all the perennial rivers of Asia are fed by Himalayas. But what happens is that much of the settlement, the mountain settlements, are not in the river valleys. They're up in the hills. And those are the places which face a lot of acute water scarcity. They're too far away from the glacier. And they are too high above the rivers, because the rivers there are quite narrow. And, you know, so it's those are not the places where you can settle. So the settlements are in the middle of the mountains. And those are the places where we found acute water scarcity, because the springs, the mountain springs, which are the only source of water for the mountain people, were increasingly drying up. And we found that they were drying up. And this was the work that I was doing when I was in this mountain institute called ICIMOD, International Center for Integrated Mountain Development in Nepal. And that's a intergovernmental organization that works in 8 countries of the Hindu Kush Himalayas. So we found that the springs were drying up due to primarily 2 reasons. One was climate change related related reason. That was changes in the rainfall pattern. But even more importantly, it was drying up due to infrastructure, due to other demographic, but more importantly, infrastructure construction. So there was a lot of dam building, lot of road building activities happening in the Himalayas. And these are quite complex geologies. So what would essentially happen in simple terms is you have on one side of the mountain, the source where the water falls and recharges the spring. And when a road kind of cuts through that area, and the spring basically gets recharged in one point, and the discharge point is the spring where the water comes out. But between the recharge point and the discharge point, suppose a road cuts through, which means that basically the flow path of that water gets disrupted. So increasingly, and the same was happening for hydropower. With the hydropower construction, a lot of blasting of the mountain, which meant that the geological structure within the mountains were disturbed. So which meant that the springs were increasingly drying up. So there, our work was quite interesting in the sense that we looked at the hydrogeology, the geology of the mountains, which in the Himalayas is super complex, as you can imagine. And then we were able to actually also use some of the more isotope tracing kind of science, but also much more local knowledge-based geology, like asking people of where the traditional sources of recharge was. And it was quite interesting because they really knew quite a lot about what the traditional places of recharge were. So by using high-tech science, by using field geology, and by using local indigenous knowledge, we were able to effectively demarcate the areas of recharge, and we were able to do rehabilitation of those areas, and over the time able to kind of bring back some of those springs to life. And now many of the governments, including the government of India, have major rehabilitation programs around springs. So it's working largely, but the reality remains that with the kind of massive infrastructure building that we are seeing in the Himalayas, unless those are planned properly, unless in the planning itself we take into account that how that recharge has been disrupted, all that we can do would be still a bit of a piecemeal solution. And it's a matter of great concern, because we are now seeing huge landslides in the Himalayas. Just, you know, with climate change, it's becoming just more acute. So
and that is what I wanted to ask about. So you've talked about the impact of development, particularly infrastructure development, on groundwater availability. But of course, there are also climate change impacts. Is it possible to separate those two things in some ways?
It has been scientifically a bit complex so far, given also the complex geology of those mountain springs. But I think increasingly it should be possible, because now some of the latest studies are showing the contribution of the spring flow, which is the base flow to the rivers, how that has changed due to climate change. So it is becoming increasingly possible as the signal of climate change becomes stronger and stronger. But overall, so far, particularly for the mountain glacier, for the mountain springs, is the infrastructure that remains a major cause rather than climate change per se. Climate change, on the other hand, is a major cause for, say, melting of glaciers. And melting of glaciers also indirectly kind of causes some kind of changes in the recharge to those springs. Sometimes they're directly related, sometimes not. Then climate change is also directly causing those landslides, and the landslides also impact springs. So a lot of the impact of climate change on the springs so far are a bit more indirect. But I think the more intense the climate change becomes, the more direct would be those fingerprint on spring, particularly in terms of recharge. There would be changes in the rainfall regime. There would be more rainfall in a short period of time, which means that a lot more runoff than recharge. So it should be possible in the very near future to be much more clear about what exactly is the climate change fingerprint and spring recharge.
And staying on this topic, I know you were coordinating lead author of the IPCC chapter on water. Can you, I guess this is difficult, but can you give a sort of brief overview of the messages of that chapter?
Yeah, I think I'd like to give message in terms of five key findings of that IPCC water chapter. The first is that we have very high confidence that each and every component of the water cycle has been transformed by climate change. By that, I mean there have been changes in rainfall, which can be actually linked to anthropogenic climate change. Then there have been changes in the permafrost component, in the cryosphere component, the frozen material, basically the glaciers and the permafrost. So then there has been changes in the groundwater. Basically, every component of the physical water cycle that you can think of has been affected by climate change. And in almost majority of the region, that impact has been negative. The second part of that is because the overall water cycle has been changed due to climate change. What happens is basically the warmer the atmosphere, the more the moisture, and then how it's distributed kind of is quite localized. So because of the extensive changes in the water cycle overall, the second main finding of our study was that because water is used in every sector of the economy, so all those sectors have felt the impact of climate change, either directly or indirectly. And agriculture being the largest consumptive user of water, that's where we see most of the impacts, because that's also a sector which is like most directly dependent on weather and climate. So we have in that assessment looked at the impacts of climate change through changes in water cycle and all the sectors, agriculture, industry, urban, etc., health, etc. Then our third finding is that all of those impacts have been largely negative, with some very minor positive impacts in the temperate zones where the growing season has extended. But those impacts will not remain positive for very long, because those would be very soon negated by things like more wildfire, you know. So those those positive impacts are not really a good news. They may be a good news in a very short term, but the long term, as long as we keep pumping more CO2 into the atmosphere, there's no really positive side of climate change. I think that would be important to emphasize, particularly in this particular climate where there's a lot of climate denial going on. Then the third part of our finding was that the ones those are most affected happen to be the more vulnerable parts of the society. So be it agriculture is a case in point. Agriculture traditionally in majority of the countries, particularly in the global south, has somehow become the parking lot for the poor. That's where some of the most poorest and the vulnerable get their livelihood. And those are the ones who are most affected. So our assessment picked up the injustice part of it. The fourth finding from our chapter is that there is a lot of adaptation happening. Water is a principle, is a very important component when it comes to adaptation to climate change. So a lot of the adaptation and a lot of the adaptation measures we were finding in terms of, say, irrigation, in terms of rainwater harvesting, better urban water use, wastewater, those were happening quite extensively all throughout the world. But the effectiveness of those adaptation in reducing climate risks are kind of not uniform. In some places they're effective, but more often than not they're not as effective as they could be, partly because of lack of finance, lack of technology, etc. So we did an assessment of water related adaptation in the sectorally. And then our fifth finding was that while water is not taken, is not a big part of the mitigation discussion, most of the mitigation, like when you try to reduce greenhouse gas emission, water plays an important role. I mean, we only think of carbon in terms of greenhouse gas emission reduction, which is true, but a lot of those methods that reduces CO2 has an implication on water. For example, in the agriculture sector, one of the ways people have tried to reduce is through bioenergy crops. But the moment you use bioenergy crop, that has got localized impacts on water and food systems. So we also pointed out the trade-offs between mitigation and adaptation. So those were basically the five major things. To sum up, The physical, the water cycle has changed substantially, and we can see the fingerprints of climate change in all components of the water cycle. And I think I forgot to mention a major part in which people experience climate change is through change in water cycle, be it droughts or floods. The second one was the sectoral impact, particularly pronounced in agriculture. The third one was the particularly pronounced impact on the vulnerable parts of the communities and societies. The fourth one was the important role of water in adaptation, and the final one was more around water also needs to be recognized as a player in the mitigation decisions that we take, because mitigation should not make local level water scarcity worse off.
Yeah, that last one is interesting, particularly in South and Southeast Asia, where hydropower becomes more and more important, and in a sense it's a climate positive thing, but on the other hand, as you say, it can have very negative impacts on other sectors of the economy, particularly agriculture, depending on how it's implemented. So,
and particularly when you're doing this, is related to our spring discussion, right? I mean, all the places where you can build hydropower are these mountainous areas, and the Himalayas as an active mountain zone is very fragile. So building those hydropower for energy security then endangers other aspects of lives and livelihoods. So I think those are the kind of the trade-offs that we have to be much more carefully think about those trade-offs.
And on adaptation, I know you've done some work on the declining effectiveness of adaptation measures as the global temperature increase moves up the ladder as you get beyond 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. Is there a tipping point there? You know, what's your advice to governments on how they need to change their adaptation strategies as you get beyond 1.5 degrees?
Yeah, I think I wouldn't say that there is just one exact tipping point, but I would say that we really need to hold on to that 1.5 degree. And that was also something that the recent advisory, the International Court of Justice advisory opinion, also said that 1.5 was not just an aspirational thing. It is more legally binding, because for some of the most vulnerable areas and communities, 1.5 tends to be the red line. Thinking of some of the Pacific communities, 1.5 is the difference between, you know, staying literally afloat and sinking. So I would say not just as a physical tipping point, but also as a social and economic tipping point, that 1.5, holding on to that, is super important. Then I also wanted to give some specific examples around why in that paper that we worked on, it was a part of the IPCC assessment, and then we also published it separately. We found that majority of the adaptation options that we have now just would not be so effective in a warmer world. A very good example from an agriculture perspective is the climate resilient seeds that our breeders are making, right? And the breeders are able to do a lot, but there are some physical limitations to what they can do. A very good example is in 2022, India had this series of heat waves, and the heat waves usually in India comes towards the second half of April, early May. But increasingly, the heat waves have started happening much earlier in the season. So the 2020 heat wave is of particular importance, because that started as early as early March, which is unthinkable. Early March is still when it's still there's no way there should have been a heat wave at that point. And early March is also the time when the wheat starts flowering. So any amount of here, the adaptation could be either irrigation or more climate resilient, like heat tolerant seeds. But my understanding is that the heat tolerant seeds are just not equipped to withstand those kind of heats. We were talking of 47, 48 degrees heat at a point when the seed is about, when the plant is about to flower. So that's the problem. Most of our heat tolerant seeds have been designed for the later maturity stage, right? So there are those physical limits, like physiological limits to what some of those adaptation can do. So in spite of even farmers, traditionally, who have irrigation, say farmers in northwest part of India, who have assured irrigation, even they couldn't save their crops simply because the temperatures were too high. So, and as far as I understand, talking to breeders, it's really difficult to breed something that would withstand that kind of high heat during the, you know, the flowering stage of the crop. So there are those kind of physical limits. There are many more examples of such limits happening. So therefore, it's absolutely important to really, for all the countries to remain within the commitments of 1.5 degree. And it's a target. It seems we are increasingly losing. I mean, last year we exceeded 1.5. It doesn't mean that we have lost it completely, but we are certainly on a path of exceeding it. It's a huge concern.
Now, we're speaking in Canberra. You're here for the annual conference of the Crawford Fund. What do you think Australia has to offer in relation to water management and climate adaptation, particularly in the context of water supply? What do you think Australia has to offer other countries around the world?
I think here the science is like there's a huge network of the universities and CSIRO and ACIR. There's a huge research capital that you have here in Australia. So a lot of those sharing, and Australia is one of the most water scarce country in the world. Some of the lessons of how you have managed your water, which I also reckon has not been as good as it could have been. But there are essential lessons that I think. So my first recommendation, and I know we are doing that already, like CGIAR works, like Australian CGIAR works so closely, and there is so much of scientific exchange. I think more and more of these exchanges around on science, and I would also bring in a bit around not only water, but also livestock and, you know, crops. So the whole gamut of the lessons that Australia has for the rest of the world. And also kind of, both way learning kind of a thing, because, I mean, Australian scientists also work in other parts of the world. So scientific would be one. Then certainly the funding support would be something that would be also quite fundamental in doing some of the work in some of those less resource areas. And I think when it comes to climate change itself, some of the, like, reducing the greenhouse gas footprint and within Australia, because that also would have a huge impact globally, but also to transfer that knowledge of how the other countries whose agriculture are kind of developing, how to do that without, you know, without making the mistakes that perhaps some of the developed countries might have made, some of the mistakes that India, China might have made in Green Revolution era. So I think like moving on to the next frontier of how can you develop your agriculture sector without necessarily pumping a lot of greenhouse gas into the atmosphere. I would think of those three as the important: research collaboration, funding, and low emission agriculture pathway that covers not only water, but livestock, crop production, the whole gamut of agriculture.
Mm. And my last question, you have just within the last few weeks, you've transitioned from your previous role heading the climate platform of the SIGEA system to the International Livestock Research Institute, I think principal climate scientist. And that might surprise people given your very strong focus on water management through the years, but I guess it should not surprise people. Can you explain how your experience brings you to that role?
Yeah, so I think this role of mine would be very much around the climate hat that I have been wearing for the last whatever since my IPCC experience. And so one of the things that I would be doing at ILRI would be to lead one of our flagship programs. It's called the Livestock and Climate Solutions Hub. And the idea is to say that while livestock is globally responsible for quite substantial greenhouse gas emissions, the livestock discourse needs to be quite different between the global north and the global south. But particularly for pastoral populations, say in Africa, livestock is not only a livelihood, but it's a way of life. It's a culture. And also looking at already very low protein intake of the population in general. So livestock needs to have a different discourse vis-a-vis the global north versus South, which right now, again, there's a bit of an uniformity in discourse. So at ILRI, we are trying to make sure that the voices of the livestock communities from the Global South, particularly the pastoral communities, are well recognized within the climate discourses, so that we don't do, you know, like a one narrative around livestock. And that's the role I'm very excited to play in the coming months. And water will, of course, also play an important role in that, because increasingly these communities are facing a lot of challenges, water being one of them. So, for example, drought. I mean, the livestock, the pastoral communities in the arid and semi-arid parts of Africa have been facing like huge amounts of droughts in the recent months, recent years. And a lot of it has a very distinct climate change fingerprint. So at ILRI, we also work on how are these communities adapting to climate change. So I'm looking forward to bringing my expertise around the climate policy as well as on water to bear on some of these questions.
Hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much for speaking with me today. It's been a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity.
Dev Policy Talks is the podcast of the Australian National University's Development Policy Centre. Show notes are posted to Simplecast. Our producers are Robin Davies, Amita Monterola, and Finn Clark. You can read and subscribe to our daily blogs on aid, international development, and the Pacific at devpolicy.org. And you can follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, and Twitter. You can send us feedback and ideas for episodes to devpolicy@anu.edu.au. Join us again in another fortnight for the next episode of Dev Policy Talks.